course I know who Stanton Lyman is, one of those Mind of the South types. Sometimes he comes on TV to explain what Creoles are, what Louisiana really believed during the Civil War, who shot Long. Nobody ever seems to remember these things for sure. All the big questions are still left open, I've noticed, in Louisiana. Are women people? Did Elvis die? Was slavery wrong? People here are still ready to argue these points.
Writer Moira Crone, reading from her new book, a collection of stories entitled Dream State. She'll be back in just a moment to read again from Dream State and to talk about her fiction. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Most of us probably think of California as this country's dream state, the lotus land of North America. But writer Moira Crone finds a better candidate in the landscapes of southern Louisiana. She sets her collection of 8 new stories in the unpredictable and fabulous ironies radiating from the steamy terrain in and around New Orleans. In Dream State, according to novelist Richard Ford, Moira Crone gives us a provocative blend of the sensual and the spiritual. Novelist Lee Smith says that Dream State delivers prose that's precise and hallucinatory at the same time. Moira Crone is the author of The Winnebago Mysteries and Other Stories and A Period of Confinement. She grew up in the tobacco country of eastern North Carolina and has lived in southern Louisiana for the past 15 years. With an excerpt from her new book, Dream State, here's Moira Crone.
I'm assuming you know who Jessica Broussard is. I just saw her this afternoon. She doesn't look like anybody now, after what she's been through, Julian, L.A., that house. But I notice her. You can't undo the past. The first time she calls me, she says, Beryl Jackson? With the faintest Louisiana accent, something she never got a chance to use on screen. I know immediately. Of course, I've heard a lot of things already, not just the stuff in the supermarket magazines. People in St. Sebastianville have been telling me she isn't from a good family, right after they proclaim they've always known her all their lives, always knew she'd be a star.
Moira Crone, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Well, I'm very happy to be here.
Congratulations on Dream State. I thought Dream State was California. You put it in Louisiana. Tell me about that.
I think that a lot of people project things on the Deep South, and I think that the Deep South is the location of a lot of the unconscious of America. And insofar as Louisiana is an unconscious place in the United States, or where those things people would rather forget but only remember in their dreams, then I think Louisiana is the dream state of the U.S.
Now, there's you've really put a lot on the table there in front of us, a lot of psychology and a lot of art and regionalism. Do you work at that consciously in the sense of when you write a story like Dream State, here's the title story in your collection, you've got all that floating in the back of your mind, or do you let the characters sort of take their own lives and live them?
I let the characters take their own lives and live them. I think that the situation when I constructed it, though, had a lot of the qualities of people coming back and trying to live a life that's already been projected in film and in American myths like Gone with the Wind.
Right.
People are returning to Louisiana to relive those in the present day. It's like a gigantic motif, the actress says at one time. And she says that the actress is the protagonist in the story. She says that it's Big South Theater. That's how she wants her wedding to be.
Right. Local color here. I don't know if it's in that story or elsewhere in your book. Local color. People go blind looking at the local color.
Yeah, that's a critique that somebody makes about South Louisiana. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Dream State itself. That is to say, the title story. You've got you mentioned the protagonist, whose name is Jessica Broussard. She's an actress. She doesn't come from exactly a good family. She's gone away, become a big star. Now she comes back, and she's dealing with your narrator, whose name is Beryl Jackson. What happens to these two women?
Beryl Jackson is a person who was raised all over the country, and she becomes a real estate agent in South Louisiana, and they think she must be from the north because she's not from South Louisiana, even though she's not from anywhere.
Uh-huh.
Jessica is an actress who comes back after a lot of failures in Hollywood, and some terrible marriages or palimony suits. And she has some money, but she has lost a lot of her reputation. Some people say she'll never work in Hollywood again.
Mm-hmm.
She's returning to her hometown, and she's trying to figure out where to live. I think she's trying to figure out what her community might possibly be in this place. It's a sort of standard South Louisiana town, and she's progressively goes through different houses that represent different social groups. She doesn't fit into any of them.
Well, you're really kind of having some fun with this, aren't you? I mean, your narrator here is a real estate agent. Real estate, get it?
Yeah.
You know, what is real? What isn't real? Is this another, a variation on how you Southern writers play with the play with place and location? Try to figure out who is where and what's happening.
Maybe. I think I might be a post-Southern writer because I'm interested in these issues. But I've never felt particularly grounded in the South, even mm-hmm. though I was raised here. Sense of place has always been associated with nostalgia and longing for me, not particularly that I'm there, uh-huh. that I'm where I ought to be.
Was it you or one of your friendly critics who said that it's time to drive a stake through the heart of William Faulkner and get on with Southern fiction? Tell me about that.
Well, the reviewer in the New York Times said that I could not be compared to Faulkner in any respect, and that he'd never read a Southern writer that you couldn't compare to Faulkner in any way.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he put me in that category.
Well, let's pause on this for a moment before we come back to Beryl and Jessica. In what way do you think of yourself as participating in the tradition of Southern literature, or is that all just sort of academic talk and you don't really pay attention to it?
It's hard for me to say. It's hard for me to say. I thought about it. I think I am a Southern writer. I am a native Southerner.
Uh-huh.
The problems of the simple problems or the straightforward problems which we've always seen in Southern letters, the problems of white country people, the problems of the small town, the sociology of the small town, black and white, and relations between black and white, these are not my major themes. So in that sense, I'm not primarily concerned with those issues.
Your fiction, as I read it, Moira, is driven by these characters and what goes on, the psychology of what goes on in these relationships that they spin away from, that they come back to. Here, let's come back to Jessica and to Beryl. How would you describe the dynamic between these two women? What is it that makes it particularly Southern that's going on between them? Anything, in fact?
I don't know. Beryl is really taken in by Jessica because she's so famous. And so she has she participates in the cult of celebrity.
Uh-huh.
She feels that her life takes on nuance and importance because she's involved with somebody who's been in movies.
Uh-huh. But Beryl's also very smart. I mean, she's no dummy, and she's not being simply seduced by fame and celebrity. Have I got this right?
Yeah, I think she's smart. I think she's also, though, she can't help herself. And she wants her life to have more reality than it seems to.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow Jessica is more real than she is.
Give our listeners a sense of what happens, again, to these two women. I mean, as a writer, do you worry about things like beginnings and middles and ends and happy endings and resolutions and putting a bow on the box of the story?
I do think about those things a lot. I think a lot about form. I think a lot about structure in stories. This story has something of the structure of The Great Gatsby. It's about a person who's watching from a distance but gets drawn into the drama of mm-hmm. another person's life and history. Jessica has a history in this town. She has a relationship with a man named Julian Pendergrast, and he's become a very prominent restaurateur, and he's renovating a big plantation mansion.
Right.
And ultimately, there's the relationship between Jessica and Julian's identification with Jessica becomes tragic in its final evolution, and Beryl's trying to deal with these things.
Do you know these women, Moira? I mean, where is it that you invent them? Where is the space? Is it they just out there in the world as real flesh and blood human beings, or how does your imagination work on the kinds of people that you observe?
It's hard to say. I know a lot about real estate because I've looked at a lot of houses in South Louisiana. It's a real recreational activity for a lot of people. And I do know something about real estate. I'm interested in the idea of real estate. Richard Ford wrote this whole novel about a real estate agent.
Frank Bascom.
I love that book. I really think it's marvelous. Mm-hmm. And
that's called Independence Day.
Yes, yes. And Richard lives in New Orleans, and we've talked about this before. I think Beryl and Jessica are two aspects of myself, in a sense, uh-huh. and that Jessica's kind of wild celebrity is I'd say she probably does come a little bit from People magazine, you know, people whose lives you read about in different phases.
Uh-huh. Do you think of yourself in any fashion, Moira, as a kind of anthropologist? Or you talked about the sociology of small communities. Are you, I will not say that your fiction is laden with messages, but should we read it in any sense as a commentary on life in the modern South? Are they, after all, stories of manners as well as individual human dynamics?
I think as a group they are. I think that as a group the stories give a kind of breadth of different ranges of characters who exist in the Deep South right now.
And what's the nature of this commentary? Do you like what you see? Do you like living in New Orleans? Are you happy with what, you know, the kinds of psychological and social portraits that you present here?
Yes, I actually like Louisiana very much. I think it's incredibly rich, and I feel very much at home there. I feel that it's always been true about Louisiana, that everything in American history somehow landed there and never left. That all of the things that one might remember about America
uh-huh.
are even very old things, like the French and Spanish claims on America, or communities of Native Americans, the history that's been buried elsewhere, like the history of freedmen of color, is completely clear and still exists in Louisiana.
Well, this would account for that passage that we heard you read at the head end of our program about the big questions that persist in the South. Is Elvis dead? Are women real? Was slavery wrong? I mean, we laugh at this, and I suppose you wanted to get a rise out of us when you wrote those words, but in a way, that is the South, is it not?
Well, it is truly Louisiana. There's an enormous overlay here in Durham where there's enormous breadth, and you feel often in Durham now that you're in California, where uh-huh. people are lacking completely in history.
Well, now, wait, that's Chapel Hill.
Oh, Chapel Hill. Oh, sorry.
But, not so much Durham.
I think as you further south you go, there's more and more residue. Uh-huh. More and more is left, and some people would say still unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that respect, I'm very happy to be in Louisiana, because anything I might want to think or say or know about America is already there.
You mentioned Moira Crone, your collection is called Dream State, and you mentioned a few minutes ago your preoccupation, your interest in form, aesthetics. One of your stories is called Desire. And we have these wonderful lines, the conundrum of form that runs through this. Are you a sort of philosopher here of aesthetics? It's a story that's about a seduction or about desire itself. It's also about the writer's life. Tell us about that.
That story, the subject of that story, in a sense, is finding the meaning in a story that a person is recalling. And as he recalls it, he's finding its content. It's like he says at the end that all the things as he recalls them are hollow, but now that they're gone and past, and he actually has become a Buddhist monk at the end of the story,
uh-huh.
These things are brimming and gorgeous.
This is as close as you come to theory, isn't it? I mean, as I read this, I thought about, you know, all these sort of French literary theorists, and the word desire is very large in that vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I on the right track?
Yes, I think so, yes. I think it's a story about the nature of yearning, I think, mm-hmm. and you read a story to find out, to have some kind of a consummation or satisfaction, and the story lacks that, but then there's an ending to the story. I mean, he has his consummation of his affair, but it's very unsatisfying to him. But now, in recollection, It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. You have another story here called I Am 11, and the voice that we hear from the page there is Ariel McKinley, a little girl who's 11 years old, and she's observing a very uncomfortable social situation between her brother and parents, and the brother has gotten a Lebanese girl pregnant. Mm-hmm. How'd you come up with the story as story? How did you create the voice of this child that we hear speaking to us from the pages?
Mm-hmm. Part of it has to do with some things I observed when I was younger in my small town that I lived in eastern North Carolina. And then I projected it on another social scene, South Louisiana scene. The voice is very youthful, and it sort of came out of me, just as I would have spoken these things when I was that age.
Is that what happens to you when you sit at the word processor or with your pen and pencil? Do you actually hear the voices in your head and then just sort of transcribe them? Is that how the muse works for Moira Crone?
I do hear, yes. Hearing is a big part of it. Hearing is a big part of it. A lot of the stories, I hear the voice. And I'm very interested in first-person voices. And once I sort of know who the narrator is, then I know what the story means. Because once you can hear the narrator well, you understand the motivation for the telling.
And the chestnut question is, do they have lives of their own? How do they live in your head and find their way onto the page here in front of us?
I think they do, yes. Sometimes they talk to me, yes. Yes, sometimes they completely take off. And you don't really know what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually when some part of your unconsciousness kicks in and starts taking the story over and solving the problems that you can't solve. And that's usually the best part of a story or a novel, I think.
Moira Crone, we're talking about your collection, Dream State. Let's talk about one of your stories here called Fever. Here we have a married couple with a little baby, and a guy's name is David Wheelock, and he gets involved with Camille Hébert. Do I say that right?
Yes, that's right.
What happens to these people?
David has probably got some problems with his wife that he's not completely clear about.
She's on the road.
She's on the road. Uh-huh. She's a professional, and he sort of declined in his professional life. They've moved to New Orleans. She's working as an occupational lawyer, helping people with suits. She's traveling in the Midwest.
And he gets involved with Camille. What happens between the two of them?
She has a fever, and so she can't leave the house. And she's a Cajun woman who wants to be a singer. And she's come to town to do some performance, but she comes by his house, and then he can't get her to go. And then finally she makes him very sick, and then the baby gets sick, and then the next thing you know, they're in bed together. And the wife comes back, and that's the end of the marriage.
And you got this wonderful line here where David says to Gwen, "Don't you know we are lived as much as we live? We are driven as much as we drive. You can't prevent everything, darling. There are things nobody can see coming." You know, now, that's fiction, okay, but it's also kind of grim. Am I taking this too far? That's pretty bleak as a kind of comment about the way human beings live. Will you react to that?
Well, I feel that there's a certain, what other people in the United States might call fatalism, which I don't necessarily think, and therefore they think it's depressing in some sense, mm-hmm. but I don't necessarily think, first of all, that that's the only worldview that one encounters in South Louisiana. I think it's truly Caribbean area, insofar as such a worldview would not be necessarily considered an unhappy one.
And this goes to the fever. This goes to
yes.
They just get caught up in something that's larger than they are.
Yes, I think that there is, I've had this experience myself in Louisiana, uh-huh. that the things do carry you along. And there's a lot of sense of ritual very often mm-hmm. that's used to heal. There's a lot of sense of community. There are a lot of large, organized, communal aesthetic activities.
Sure. Now, I don't mean to make it sound entirely negative.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some wonderfully funny sections in this story, too. This guy David taking this little baby Charlotte, and he's going down to this bar and watching the Camille sing, and you drop these wonderful little sort of italicized instructions from booklets
yeah,
that people run into, you know, how to care for babies and how to handle a stroller and
yeah.
Instructions for life kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I think that story and Gauguin are both stories about a kind of Yankee worldview coming in complete conflict with a much more fluid a social set of goals.
And what's a Yankee worldview, just parenthetically?
Well, the idea that one lives according to a certain life plan and that certain things are going to happen.
Now, I'm on top of it.
Yeah, I'm on top of it. Yeah. And the ego is always at the wheel. Mm-hmm. This is a very Yankee view. I think that this is challenged by life in South Louisiana.
Right.
And I think many people feel that the moment is a whole lot more important than the long view. This is very characteristic of a lot of aspects of interaction.
Does this have anything to do, not so much, I guess, with climate and region and things like that, as the infusion, the kind of presence of art in a way in that region, in South Louisiana, that you don't necessarily find it as richly, as thickly, you know, as visible in other parts of the country?
I think so. I think that there's a high value placed on enjoying the moment,
mm-hmm.
And in
pleasure,
having a
pleasure,
good pleasure,
right.
Yes, and also an aesthetic experience, which is what pleasure often is. You know, there's a lot of seriousness. Pleasure is taken extremely seriously in South Louisiana, and this is a difference, and this is why everybody else in America loves to go there.
Well, it's known as a colorful place. It's known as a place to go and have wonderful food and, you know, look at Carnival and Mardi Gras.
And hear wonderful music, mm-hmm. and the art is really very interesting in South Louisiana.
Well, that takes us to the last story in your collection, Moira, and that would be Gauguin. Here's a young man by the name of Paul who's torn between two parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
After a fashion, and he gets in again. It's hopeless to try to recite the particularities of the plot here, you know, for our listeners. But give us a quick sense of what goes on in this story and why art matters in it.
In Gauguin, Paul is an environmental lawyer. He wants to stay and he wants to leave. He wants to go to Wellfleet, Massachusetts, for a weekend, and he would very much like to leave South Louisiana, which some of his friends in the Northeast who went to Harvard with him think of as Tahiti. They think of it as the most exotic place in the world. And they're trying to get him out. It's like a group project to get Paul out of South Louisiana where he's working. And then the weekend he's supposed to go see his old girlfriend in Wellfleet, Hurricane Andrew comes.
Yeah, he's waiting for the hurricane to hit, and he's also we also feel the effects of the David Duke phenomenon down there.
Yes, the David Duke phenomenon.
Sort of a political barometer as well as a meteorological one, huh?
And, and the David Duke campaign is something he's recollecting while he's dealing with the hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
And it came almost exactly a year before Hurricane Andrew. These things were 1 year apart.
So why do you call the story Gauguin? Why do you name it for this artist?
Mostly because of the ending of the story. He's walking outside after the hurricane, and he sees these women standing in the stairways of their homes and the porches, looking out on all the destruction. And he recalls immediately the painting by Gauguin, which is "Where have we been? Where are we? Where are we going?" Which is a triptych, which is extremely mystical and strange. And it's what he recalls, and that's the reason I named the story Gauguin. Also,
mm-hmm.
because of the story of Gauguin having left a structured existence in Paris and running away to Tahiti.
Well, you've got this line here: "Does what you want have much to do with how your life plays out?" Again, the free impulse and the structured impulse interacting with one another in this young man's life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, and when this person says that that's not a problem, that what you want has little to do with how your life plays out, he's shocked by that remark. But I do think that you can find in South Louisiana, as you can in many places such as beaches throughout the United States,
right.
and other places, people who have figured out that even if you don't get what you want in life, there's plenty there. The way that everybody in society is so overwhelmed by celebrity and feels themselves not to be real because what's real is something that's projected towards them,
not
their own life.
If you're not on TV, you're not real. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. It's a big revelation for the character to say everybody is real the same, not some more real and others less real. This is like something she has to figure out.
Moira Crone is the author of Dream State, a collection of stories available from the University Press of Mississippi. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. Before that, here again is Moira Crone with another excerpt from Dream State.
This is a concluding passage from the story Gauguin, in which a man named Paul is torn between staying in Louisiana and returning to New England, where he's from. The weekend he's supposed to go to New England, he's hit with Hurricane Andrew. And then he takes a walk out in the hurricane aftermath. And when he tells the story, he always jumps a little ahead at this point to that walk they took. It was about 2:30, and the winds had died down, and he and Diana and A.J. ventured out into her wrecked yard. Paul was carrying his flight bag. The airport was open. Down St. Helena, almost every tree was down or damaged. Things that were hidden before, he noticed, were exposed now by the winds, the flashy white wood inside old branches, the underside of the leaves all silver. Immaculate was the word that came to mind. They passed many women, their neighbors, standing on their porches, their front doors flung open, looking out at the damage. Smashed cars, lost roofs, twisted bikes, flooded yards, with a grand and easeful awe, the drizzle blowing in their faces. He felt as if he were in that very late painting of Gauguin's. He always mentions this part, the one with the royal pink sky in the background, and the bare-breasted maidens in it who are gazing up mysteriously at something not pictured on the canvas itself. There are tropical vines in the background. For him, these are power lines snaking downward. He's supposed to be going to the corner where Diana's brother Danny, the deputy sheriff, out cruising to discourage looters, has agreed to pick him up to take him to the airport. He's planning to dash out onto the runway in the post-hurricane excitement, perhaps holding a sturdy airline umbrella. He's planning to board his flight to escape to New England.
You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was writer Moira Crone. Partial funding for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Audio tapes are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to us at Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 815. That's program number 815. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Showing My Color, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and NPR commentator Clarence Page will be here to talk about his new book, Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.